Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Artemis endeavors to get more women in the field and on the water.
To support women as leaders in the conservation movement.
To ensure the vitality of our lands, waters, and wildlife.
Artemis endeavors to change the face of conservation.
I'm your host, Carly Kutnick, and today we do not have a co-host, so we're just going to go ahead and jump right to our guest. Today, we are welcoming Jaden Hronica. Am I saying that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Awesome. To the show. And she is one of our new ambassadors for Artemis and is part of the 2023 cohort. So how are you doing today, Jaden?
I'm doing very well. How about yourself?
It's a good day. I can't complain. It's beautiful outside. We've had a lot of rain. It's pretty.
I'm jealous. We need some here.
Colorado. I would say I've seen it green like this before, but it's very rare for it to be this green. It's absolutely breathtaking right now.
Oh, I can imagine. Everything's brown here and I'm not used to that. Usually the other way around.
That is so sad. But there's always time for it to turn around, right?
There is, for sure. Yeah, hopefully some rain tonight actually coming. So fingers crossed.
Yeah, good, good. Yeah, you'll have to let me know. Okay, so first question on the docket that we ask all of our guests is, what's in your freezer?
Yeah, so not much is in my freezer right now. I have some venison left over, and my dad makes an amazing trail bologna. So I have that saved in there. But otherwise, some frozen blueberries and some frozen bananas for banana bread, but that's about it.
That sounds fantastic. Tell me a little bit about this trail bologna. I am unfamiliar.
So, my dad has this really good recipe. He combines a bunch of, I think he's got like pheasant in there and venison and obviously some like pork fat and stuff to hold it all together. And then he smokes it for a really long time and then you like pan fry it and it's just amazing.
That sounds fantastic. Is this a family recipe or is this something that you're willing to share?
It's not a family recipe. So, I mean, I could definitely share it with you in the future. But yeah, it's just something that he found on either online. I think it's, he just found like a spice packet kind of thing. And yeah, it's, like I said, everyone loves it. And he brings it everywhere as like a, and passes it around. So he's very proud of it.
It's his token party favor.
It really is, yes.
That's great. Okay, tell us a little bit about who you are, what you do, where you're from.
Sure. So I am from Wisconsin, and I would just say that I'm an independent girl who really loves nature and music, being with my family and friends. I love fly fishing. And I just have a curiosity to always learn and be open to new experiences. And that's led me to really gravitate towards working on Wisconsin's ecosystems. So I've always had a passion for the outdoors, and I think that really developed even more by going to Trout Unlimited when I was younger with my dad and learning how to fly fish from him. Then I decided to go to school for land restoration at the University of Wisconsin-Platteville. And after I graduated, I found a job in the Madison area as a restoration tech. And I'm still with that same company today, but as a project manager now. And I think being with my company really made me realize what an incredible, special place Wisconsin is. And there's so much that people overlook about the state. And so it's been a real privilege to be able to work on some of these rare ecosystems and also bring fire back to the landscape again.
Tell me a little more about these ecosystems. Which, you know, what gambit do they run in Wisconsin, and which one's your favorite in particular?
Sure. So to go back a little bit, Wisconsin is divided by a tension zone, it's called. So it's basically like a climatic gradient of like boreal forest to the north. So that's a combination of a lot of pine trees and like red oaks, and also species like loons and grouse are up there. And then in the southern portion of the state, it's more of a prairie and oak savanna type ecosystem. And so you can really see this distinction when you're driving from the south to the north. And so because of this, I think oak savannas are my favorite ecosystem. It's where what we work on most of the time. It's also one of the rarest ecosystems in the world. So we're pretty in a good spot to help restore some of these areas. It's also in the heart of the Driftless region, which the Driftless region is in Wisconsin, but it's also a little bit part of Minnesota, the eastern part of Iowa, and the northern tip of Illinois. But during the last glacial period, it's where 10,000 years ago is where glaciers didn't touch this point. So there's a lot of like ancient, you know, a lot of different ecosystems that you will not find anywhere else, and old rolling hills where the rest of the state, it's, you know, majority of it's pretty flat. So it definitely stands out, and also home to a ton of trout streams. I believe Wisconsin leads the nation in miles of high class one quality trout streams. It's like 3,500 miles or something like that. So it's pretty cool. I live in a great spot.
Are trout your favorite species to fly fish for? Or, I mean, yeah, I guess which type of trout do you love most? And also, this is really fascinating. I have so many questions.
That's great. No, there's a lot here. So yeah, trout, you know, brown trout are here. We have brook trout, I think, are our only native species. Brown trout are not from the States at all, actually. They're native to Germany. And yeah, that area. So I would say brook trout are my favorite because of that. And they are also in these like really tight little streams that are hard to fish at times. And so it just makes them more of a challenge. And they're just beautiful.
I agree. I think pursuing trout is a lot of fun. Tell me a little bit more about these oak savannas. What can you describe them? What are some of the plants and like flora and fauna that exist there, and what makes them so unique?
Yeah. So a lot of times in oak savannas, they are these massive, they're probably like 300 or so year old oak trees that are usually bur oak and white oak, mostly bur oak. But they are very almost picturesque and like park-like. If you imagine like the lower branches of an oak tree just extending really wide, where they have just a ton of open space to grow and their branches are just like limitless. That's how these oak trees look. And then in the understory, it's more of just unique prairie vegetation. So we have, you know, rattlesnake master and goldenrod species and lead plant and big blue stem, little blue stem, just a ton of variety. of prairie plants in the in the understory. So they're just really cool, almost like park-like, I would say. So that's why it's so different from other places, and it's why it really needs fire to sustain because of the prairie plants and stuff there.
That's fantastic. On a side note, I think I shared on one of our previous episodes that I'm transitioning my entire backyard to native plants in Colorado. And I, not all native plants, but some xeric plants. And I came across lead plants, and I think they're so fantastic. And so I finally have my first lead plant, and I planted it last week. So pretty happy about that.
That's so cool. It's very exciting. Yeah, they're one of my favorites too.
Yeah. Tell me, I guess, if you don't mind elaborating on that.
I'd love to
hear your expertise on it.
Oh man, I have so many favorite plants. But yeah, I think I love Rattlesnake Master. It's in the yucca family. So that one's pretty, it doesn't look like it belongs here. We have a prickly pear cacti here. So that one's one of my favorites. There's Puccoon is a really beautiful one, and bird's foot violets. I don't know. All of them just, I really love the Silphium family too. So, that's, compass plant and prairie docks. There's so many, it's hard to choose.
I think it's fascinating. A lot of these species that you're talking about, I associate with Western landscapes. And so it's really interesting to try and put my mind in Wisconsin and think about it from, that landscape. So,
There's a lot of overlap between Wisconsin and other and prairie plants in general throughout the country. So, it is unique and it's different.
Very cool. Tell me about these prescribed burns. How much burning did you do this year? And what did they look like?
Burning, let's see, we did over, I think, 110, 120 burns as a company this year. And that varies from, we have a lot of projects in Madison area, so that's a lot more small little like prairie establishments and rain gardens. But then we also have like larger burns that we do a lot of, like we have a conservancy called Riverland Conservancy that's pretty close by, that, you know, it's a few hundred acres that we burn there every year and like rotate areas that we burn throughout the property. It really depends on where we're at. And it's everything from the oak savanna ecosystems, like I talked about, to prairie plants or just prairies and wetlands. Sometimes it's some oak woodland areas. So yeah, it's all over, and really depends on the client that we have or the area of Wisconsin that we're in.
Of course. For our listeners, what is the significance of having prescribed fire? What value and benefit does it bring to the land?
I'm glad you asked that question, because there's a lot of value that comes with prescribed fire. It is the best management tool we have to conserve these ecosystems, where we're able to impact the most amount of acres in a short amount of time. There's certain vegetation and trees that have adapted and that need fire to survive. So plants like jack pine, for an example, their cones won't open until fire comes through and opens it for them. There's longleaf pines in Florida that have adapted to it, and prairie vegetation has all adapted to fire. So they need it to be here. Also, prescribed fire helps with fuel reduction. And when I'm talking about fuel reduction, that's more so like the buildup of leaves and grass fuels and just plant vegetation in general, along with like dead trees and stuff like that. So it burns away slowly all that material. So when we come back and do it again, it's going to be less intense in the future. Then it also returns nutrients back to the soil. It increases diversity in species and plants. It's also amazing for a wildlife habitat, specifically like white-tailed deer, for an example. And also insects and disease control, invasive plant control, like literally anything. Fire really benefits or helps us with for managing these lands.
With white-tailed deer in Wisconsin and other game species, what, I guess, are there any specific, is there any specific value to having that prescribed fire for them? So I was actually listening to a podcast a couple weeks ago from the University of Florida, and they were talking about how they're seeing a decrease in overall ticks affecting white-tailed deer with prescribed burns, which I thought was, I think it's fascinating. So arthropods are fascinating.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, that's true, because a lot of ticks, they really like dense leaf litter, and they really like a lot like grassy material. And so if you burn that consistently, you'll have, yeah, less ticks for a home that they are found in and stuff. And yeah, going back to the deer, the white-tailed deer, the reason why they benefit specifically from burning is mostly for like when deer browse and stuff, they get rid of the ground layer of vegetation and they start working their way up. So when you burn, it restarts the seed bank again and brings up fresh vegetation at a ground level. So it's more foraging opportunities for them. That's easier. So that's why you see more increases in deer. And it's why indigenous people burn the land to begin with, because it would bring an abundance of and deer back to their hunting grounds.
Right. What about waterfowl and maybe upland birds? What does it look like for, what do prescribed burns look like for them?
I would say more so, so when we do burns in like wetland areas and stuff like that, we try to burn like early so the nesting isn't affected at all for them and stuff. And so I think, you know, I haven't really like studied a ton about like waterfowl and birds in particular, but I know like specifically for grassland birds, like who need that prairie vegetation, you know, it keeps all of the woody species out of the grassland areas for them. And it helps, you know, bring food and insect life that, you know, they eat back to, you know, being more abundant for them. So I think that right there is definitely a big positive. Otherwise, I'm not really sure what else they benefit from burning.
No, I agree with you. I did a little bit of prescribed fire down in Florida. I think I shared that with you when we previously spoke.
Yeah, you did.
I would still consider myself very much a novice, but I find all of this stuff really intriguing because of how much it affects an ecosystem, right? From insects to flora to invasive species to, you know, larger game species to, yeah, overall like ecosystem integrity. Fire is a really awesome thing.
So. It is really awesome. Yeah.
I know a lot of people have concerns with them affecting really a multitude of species. like either chasing them out or causing, I don't know, some sort of harm or a decrease in their population. Mm-hmm. And I know you mentioned that you try to burn at a time that, at a time where they're not breeding. Mm-hmm. What is that time frame? What and which times do you typically avoid?
So if we're, again, if we're trying to burn like wetland areas, for example, we'll try to burn that like really early in the season. So their nests aren't affected or anything like that. And that's usually in Wisconsin, our burn time is anywhere from March to like early May. So there's a very short window, and then we might have a shorter window sometime in the fall. It's usually maybe at the most like 2 weeks or so come November, maybe beginning of December kind of thing if we don't have any snow. There's a very short window to get all these in. We try to be very mindful of what animals that we're affecting. And, you know, animals too have adapted with fire throughout, you know, the years, and, you know, they know, instinctively that, you know, they can't be around, a burn area. And when we're burning around the perimeter, we're very cautious and take our time for the most part. So the animals can escape and, you know, go in to hiding holes that are like deep under the ground, so they're not gonna, you know, die at all. But yeah, there's multiple different ways that we do those things, and whether it's lighting, 20 feet off a water edge, so reptiles have a chance to go into the water that's right next to it, or burning our prairies, our goat prairies and stuff, we call them, where rattlesnakes reside. We burn those really early in the season when there's still snow on the ground and the rattlesnakes haven't come out of hibernation yet. So yeah, there's a lot of things that we try to do to help them out.
I think that's great. So I know your bread and butter is fly fishing. Mm-hmm. I am curious, do you notice a difference in the streams, right? Do you have to pay any additional attention when you are laying fire on the ground? I know you said you're always 20 feet off the mm-hmm. water, but what effects does a prescribed burn have on water?
That is a great question. Prescribed burning, definitely helps with the quantity of water. So if you're removing, like, if you're burning through like the thick shrubs and overgrown vegetation that are sometimes like right next to water, when you get rid of those plants, those shrubs and stuff, that's fewer plants that are absorbing the water. So then streams are fuller, and that also benefits other plants and animals. And it also helps maintain even clean drinking water. So it reduces the amount of moisture that evaporates from plants into the air. And this increases the quantity and improvement of the water soaking into the ground. So and it replenishes all the aquifers and stuff like that. So it does a lot too for water quality.
Yet again, why prescribed burning is necessary. Mm-hmm. I am a huge fan. We're going to take a quick break and hear from our partners, and we'll be right back. ProWis believes women hunt hard and deserve the gear to support their hunting and outdoor passions. What sets ProWis apart is our belief that women require performance outdoor gear for all of their hunting and field pursuits. Their layering systems are quite technical, but philosophically simple. Optimal base layers, prime insulation layers, and durable shell layers to stop wind and water. Take pride in not being one of the guys.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
I'm Will Cooper, and you're listening to HuntStand's Make Your Mark podcast on the Waypoint Podcast Network. Stick around as I bring you more stories and interviews from veteran hunters and industry professionals who inspire us all to be better equipped in the woods and in life.
And we're back. And again, I am here with Jaden Hronica, and we are talking prescribed fire. Jaden, you've really given me a full scope on the ecosystems that you burn, what you enjoy about it, the species that you affect. I would love to hear, what does your day-to-day look like? So on a burn day, when you show up to work, what does that look like?
A little bit chaotic, I would say. So first of all, in the morning, we're getting all the burn plans and maps and stuff ready for the crews. We're writing out lists of equipment that we need for the specific site we're burning. And then we have engines, our trucks that have a full tank and pump on it. And so we have to fill all those up and fill all of our ATV pumps and water tanks up and get all of our equipment as far as our rakes and brooms and flappers, and then our radios that we need for communication on the line. And then we all hook up all the trailers and head to the site.
What does the planning look like before you get to that point? So maybe the day before, how much time do you spend reviewing the size of the burn, mm-hmm. and where you're going to burn, which areas you anticipate are going to be challenging? What does that look like?
Yeah, so when we're planning, let's say a client, is like, I'm interested in prescribed burning on our property. So we'll do an initial site visit and they'll be like, this is the area that I want burned. Sometimes it's really easy. Sometimes it's a little bit more complex and a lot more acres than others. So we see what we need to do as far as establishing fire breaks. So either mowing them, or if it's in a woodland, we can like leaf blow day of, or sometimes it involves taking out chainsaws and clearing the area like way beforehand, like the winter before we burn. It depends on where we are going. But then once we have all that information, we have to create the burn plan and the management plan. So the burn plan is, everything from the site location to what wind direction that we need for the specific site, to what are hazards in the area that we need to be, or in the unit that we need to be mindful of, to, hospital directions. And then we have to make all the maps on QGIS. And so and make out points on all the maps so we know where we are and we can talk over the radio like, hey, I'm at drop point Bravo B. So, this is where I am, and hopefully we'll meet up in a good spot and close out the unit in a safe way. So yeah, there's a lot involved with planning out these things, and it takes a lot of time and dedication, and we're very fortunate to have a great knowledgeable crew to be able to do these.
I'm sure. And I mean, even from a safety standpoint, it's important to have folks that are educated and invested and can communicate effectively so that you don't have any, I guess, negative events occur.
Absolutely. Yeah. And Yeah, things happen. It can be a scary thing at times, and sometimes things happen that you don't expect, which is why, you know, with this job, you're always learning and always trying to adapt, and you have to think quickly. So it keeps you on your toes.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I mean, I suppose with it sounds to me like you do primarily low intensity fires, getting them out of that really low intensity space makes them quite a bit more risky. Have you done a lot of higher risk fires or prescribed burns, like where you are intentionally torching canopies, or do you usually stick with something that's a little bit more low key?
We usually stick with things that are more low key. There are times when, you know, let's say we're closing out the unit where we're going with the fire's going with the wind, then, and that creates its own head fire. You know, that's usually very intense at the last part. But for the most part, we are working towards doing low intensity fire and we call it doing dot ignition, or sometimes like flanking strip ignition. So dotting around trees that are dot or like have cat faces in them. So areas of the tree that are dead at the base or kind of like up at top where we know this tree is going to be a hazard to us to remove. So we're more mindful of like either raking around it before we light it or putting a little bit of fire right next to it and watching it so it won't like get that tree going, so we don't have more of an issue later. So we're constantly trying to mitigate those issues, because at the end of each burn, depending on the size, we have to have all of our fires have to be 100% out. And if the fire is, you know, we've done some burns that are like 600 acres or so. And obviously that one, you can't put everything out that we just lit in a day's time. So we put out the edges, the perimeter of the unit, pretty much up to 100 feet. And then we have someone stay the night to watch the fire, and to make sure it doesn't get out of hand and stuff like that.
That's awesome. Yes. my first couple burns that I went out on, we had quite a number of spot fires, just kind of leaving the boundary. And that was, you know, I think when you're so new to it, everything is an adrenaline rush and nerve wracking. But mm-hmm. seeing those, right, when you're working fire suppression, those spot fires are a little bit more, the consequences are far higher if you're not engaged on putting them out immediately. Yeah. So yeah. Have you done any suppression work?
Yeah, a lot. Yeah, we as a company, we do quite a bit of training and stuff before, you know, to help their crews and to make sure we all understand how to put out these, if in case of an escape or a spot fire, like this is what we have to do to handle the situation. And it's usually we have an anchor point, so that's usually where the fire starts, and we go up a flank and then we pinch it off, so we turn it down around the head fire to cut it off towards a trail or towards water or whatever we have. Or sometimes we have to go up both of the flanks and put out the head fire together. So yeah, it depends. There's only been one instance where I had to deal with an actual wildfire that was like close to our unit. And that was a complete fluke. And we just so happened to, like I said, to be burning in the area. And then we had to respond to this wildfire. So yeah,
man. And is burn boss the proper terminology? Were you the burn boss for the day?
Yeah, burn boss is the proper term, but no, I was not. It was the actual boss of the company. My boss, he was Burn Boss for that one. And yeah, it was a crazy experience. It just so happened the wildfire started right next to our prescribed burn sign too. So no one was calling it in. And yeah, it was very freaky, but I think it ended up burning like 78 acres or something like that, which isn't big, right. But it's big for Wisconsin.
Right. How close is that to homes, and what did that look like from a threat standpoint for urban areas?
Devastating. Luckily there wasn't too many homes. There was a barn and there was one house off of the road, and my crew ended up putting out that line before the dozer and stuff came from the DNR and everything. So we protected around the house and protected around the barn as much as we could. And then the volunteer firefighters and everything came in, and the DNR and dozed around the house to protect it. So luckily we were there. So that's all I can say.
Yes, very, very fortunate. Tell me a little bit about So what are the certifications that you need to get into this prescribed fire or fire suppression from a wildland standpoint? And I would love to hear your story as you're sharing it with us of like, how long did it take you to get these things? What did you have to do? What was it like?
Sure. So to burn anywhere, pretty much, you have to have your S-130, S-190 course. So it's usually like a 4-day course or so. And some universities offer them. And yeah, they're interesting. Some of them, they're pretty long and draining, but no, they're still very useful. Mostly useful for wildland firefighters, but again, for prescribed firefighters, anything that we do, it can become an incident. It can become a wildfire if we're not careful. So taking these classes are really important in case something does get out of hand, that we have the tools and knowledge to be able to handle it, along with like the education background. So for that, I think they're really important. But yeah, so S-130, S-190 is your first course, and then you can take ignitions. And I think there's like two other classes. There's the weather class that you can take. So you're looking at, cloud patterns and trying to decide if a front's coming in, kind of thing, which is really interesting. And then it's your, I'm forgetting what it's called specifically, but then it's your class that you can take to become a burn boss. So starting out, it's probably like four classes, and there's some intermixed that until you can take your burn boss class, and all of them are again like 4 days long. And then if you want to get into wildland firefighting, all you have to do is take a PAC test, which we're not required as prescribed burners to take a PAC test, but they are.
I didn't realize that. I thought everybody had to take the PAC test.
No. Luckily, we don't have to. I think the Nature Conservancy here in Wisconsin will make you do that, but not us independent contract companies.
Okay. Yeah. I guess I did get mine through the Nature Conservancy, so that makes sense down in Florida. So interesting. And then what's after the Burn Boss certification? What does maybe a career similar to yours, does it require more than being a burn boss, or what does that look like?
For prescribed burning, no, we don't really have any classes or a reason to take more than just our burn boss certification class. There's like some like burn boss like leadership courses that you could take. But it's not really a requirement. It's only like if you really want to. And they're usually pretty far away and a lot of money. So, but yeah, after you're a burn boss, it's more so just gaining the experience. And that in itself takes way longer than the classes will. I mean, I've been doing this for almost 5 years and there's still so much I don't know about fire. It's pretty crazy.
I mean, it's an entire discipline on its own, right? And to be a practitioner is only a small component of it. Having the background knowledge and the ecological knowledge and pulling that all together is a lot. It's people dedicate their whole lives to it, which is so cool.
Absolutely.
I'm so jealous.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, luckily we've got a good foundation here in Wisconsin. I mean, we've had people like Aldo Leopold, for an example, pave the way here. So that's the reason why I think it is like people really realize how important it is from him being here. So, yeah.
Very neat. Well, thanks. Thanks for enlightening us on the prescribed fire front. I've been wanting to, I know we're just slightly past the season now, but actually, are you doing any more fires right now? Are you laying any more fire down?
No, we're not doing any more fire right now. But again, come fall, like November, we might get a few weeks in where we can do some more burning.
Nice. Okay. So I'm curious about, I feel like we really just focused hard on the prescribed fire front, which I really enjoyed listening to you. I would love to learn more about you. What other things, tell us a little bit more about yourself and tell us about, you know, some of the things that keep you in Wisconsin, some of the things that bring you out to fly fish, and keep you really in a conservation field.
Ooh, that's a great question. I think it's the reason why I stay in Wisconsin is just because of, you know, again, I always say Wisconsin's more of like the subtle beauty. It's not in your face at all. It's just there. And, I really just appreciate that. It feels very at home to me. And I love being able to go visit places like out west and stuff like that. But to have like a place like this where I have hundreds of miles of streams to access, like that's pretty hard to beat. Along with, you know, a career that's very dedicated and just here for the right reasons. So I think, yeah, those are the things that keep me in Wisconsin. But as far as everything else, I don't know. I grew up around nature and stuff like that. And I feel like it's just in my blood, so to speak. It's, you know, something I just don't know anything different. And, yeah, I'm grateful to have that solid thing in my life.
Of course. Yeah. I feel the same way. I think it's, you know, anytime I get stressed or frustrated, nature seems to continuously ground me. It's really fantastic to just go bomb a dirt road and then hike off into the middle of nowhere and just to, I think, experience the vastness of what nature has to offer, and how, I don't know, not minor your, I think it puts things in perspective, I guess is what I'm trying to say, is that like you're just a component of the larger system.
Yes.
Which I think is.
Yeah. It humbles
grounding.
You.
Yeah. Yes.
Exactly. Grounding, humbling, yeah.
Absolutely. So that's when you say that, like I can picture Wisconsin, like it isn't just like, yeah, it's just discreet. It's it brings out, it's just lovely. It's just a very lovely place. the Midwest is always a place that is surprising, I think. So I don't know, but I've had the opportunity to live in a number of different areas, and you can find something extraordinary about each one of them. So I don't know. While I choose to live out west right now, I have a lot of appreciation for other places in the States.
Yeah, that's very cool.
So I'm curious, what other things do you do, right? What other things do you do for fun outside of work? I feel like your work and off work time probably overlap a little bit with regards to your interests. What things do you do when you head home after maybe a long day of burning, or what do you do in the off season?
Sure. Yeah. Well, I do a variety of things outside, obviously. So a lot of just kayaking and a lot of hiking. I really love music and reading and stuff like that. So I'm always going to a concert or something somewhere. And luckily, I live pretty close to Madison and Milwaukee, so it's very easy to go find shows anywhere. And yeah, otherwise, live pretty simple life. I really just enjoy being with my family and some friends here and there, and just just taking it easy, campfires, and you know, ice fishing and all those things. It's just, yeah,
things where you're fully immersed and fully present is what it sounds like.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
That's great. Well, thank you. I've really enjoyed chatting with you and learning about you. As we come to a close, we talk about what our hits and misses are for the week. And I guess I have to, so since we don't have a co-host, I guess I will have to go first on this case. And I have a lot of things in the hopper. I haven't quite, actually, okay, here's my miss for the week. Here's my miss for the season. Turkey season closed a couple of days ago, and here in Colorado, and I did not get a turkey. So I'm going to have to go ahead and give it a try next spring. So that's my miss. But what have you been aiming for? How did it go? And how did it go?
This week, this was my first full week back from vacation. So I would say my miss was, it was mostly just trying to get caught up with everything. And I'm in this, I've been a project manager for a little bit now, but I recently just got a bunch of more responsibility as far as sites being handed down to me. So it's just been a week of trying to balance all these sites and all these extra responsibilities that I have, plus still being out in the field with my crew. And so, that's been a challenge, but it's a good learning opportunity. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, trying to find that nice level of where you can actually be in the field, do those things, and also be in that manager role is that's quite the needle to thread. So, so I wish you the best of luck in that. There's a couple people I feel like that have perfected it and they've written an awful lot of books about it. I'm not there yet. So someday.
We'll both work towards it.
Yes, exactly. So awesome. Well, thank you again for sharing. And did you have anything else that you wanted to share with the Artemis podcast listeners today?
No, not that I can think of, other than, I think it's just really important to learn about the ecosystems that you have in your neighborhood and try to see if prescribed fire would be a good fit for it. And because I think burning is definitely a way we can really help our future with, you know, wildfires and everything like that. So, that would be my only thing.
Thanks. Well, thanks, Jaden. I appreciate you joining us this week on the Artemis podcast. We hope you're having a great week. And until next time, be bold, stay curious, and get outside.
I'm Will Cooper, host of HuntStand's Make Your Mark podcast. If you haven't already, download the free Waypoint TV app to listen to our podcast and watch the original films from HuntStand Presents anywhere, anytime, and on any device.